This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to our weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Quite an extraordinary story is playing out in America. And yet the day-to-day headlines are coming so fast you can almost get numb to them. But yesterday, the Speaker of the House of Representatives announced essentially a coup against President Donald Trump. This is what she said.
Good morning. Let us begin where our founders began in 1776. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bonds which have connected them with another. With those words, our founders courageously began our Declaration of Independence from an oppressive monarch, for among other grievances, the king's refusal to follow rightfully passed laws. In the course of today's events, it becomes necessary for us to address, among other grievances, the president's failure to faithfully execute the law.
Nancy Pelosi asked for articles of impeachment against President Trump to be drafted. To learn more about this, we will turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that clip that we just heard is extremely revealing as to what's actually going on here, in that you'll notice that the Speaker of the House of Representatives quoted the Declaration of Independence, not even the Constitution, but the Declaration of Independence, because the impeachment process is, or was supposed to be, a constitutional process where the House of Representatives and the Senate and the Supreme Court work together to remove a lawless executive from office. The Declaration of Independence was a declaration of rebellion against a foreign power, or what was viewed as a foreign power oppressing people's political rights. And so she's talking about cutting the bands that sunder one people to another. It's like, what people are you cutting the bands for? You're either completely unhinged, or, like I said, you are announcing a free-for-all, no-holes-barred rebellion against the Trump administration.
Yeah. So this looks like this is going to happen. There's the pretty well sure thing that the House of Representatives is going to impeach him.
Right. They've been having impeachment hearings to determine if they wanted to start the impeachment process for several weeks now. That's what happened yesterday, is the Speaker of the House announced that they've officially introduced articles of impeachment. So they are going to have a vote probably this month. She would not have announced that if she didn't think there was a good chance that they're going to get a majority in that vote. And pretty much everyone's treating it like that's what's going to happen. The Trump administration's already preparing its defense, because as soon as you get that 218th vote for impeachment, then the impeachment becomes official. This goes to trial, and the way these trials work is that since the House of Representatives is the power bringing the impeachment charge against the president, they act as the prosecutors in the trial. The White House can use its own lawyers, probably Attorney General William Barr, to mount a defense. Supreme Court Justice John Roberts will sit as the judge, and the Senate basically acts as the jury. I saw one headline that they've pretty much canceled the month of January. The Senate's probably not going to be doing anything else that month, except listening to this case. And then when it's done, the Senate, kind of like as the jury in this trial, will just take a simple vote. And if they get 67%, two-thirds majority of the Senate, the president is no longer president.
Which the chances of that happening are extremely slim. So
the chance of them getting a 50% majority are extremely slim. Yeah. There's 53 Republicans in the Senate, so I think everyone's expecting that 53% of the Senate at least is going to vote to acquit the president. So there's really almost no chance you'd get anywhere near two-thirds to remove him from office.
Which the Democrats have to understand. They know that that's the inevitable outcome of this. I guess they're thinking that just putting this stain on Donald Trump's record might be enough that it would hurt his chances for the next election. Stephen Fleury was talking about that this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and this quote from Nancy Pelosi invoking the Declaration of Independence, and in her speech she was quoting several of the founders and speaking of these very broad, grand principles of political power invoking these luminaries in American history. And these are the same people that the Democrats and that the left in America vilify in so many ways. They're pulling down statues. They're branding them all as dead white straight males that were slave owners and so on. And yet, when it's expedient, they're very happy to act like, well, they're acting in the very best traditions of American history.
Right. That is, it does just reveal just the deep hypocrisy there, because like you said, on the radical left, you have this, just this lawless movement that, like I said, does pull down statues and just, tears down the founders as these, rich, racist landowners, and, that established a constitution that oppresses people and needs to be abolished. Now, granted, that is more the Democratic activist, but even amongst Democratic senators who would normally have to carry themselves with a slightly bit more amount of dignity, you had just recently Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about that she's going to be the last president ever to be elected by the Electoral College because they want to completely abolish that part of the Constitution. Mm. Or the Kavanaugh hearings that went into the Senate. You had to confirm Justice Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And like I said, this is Nancy Pelosi and these same people just making him look like the worst person ever because of his his belief that you should interpret the Constitution literally. You heard testimony from Dianne Feinstein in that case talking about how horrible a thing it is to take the Constitution literally at its word. So this speech from Nancy Pelosi yesterday is the first good word I've heard for the Constitution in
quite a while,
in a long time, and even then, she can't name. She's talking about how well we need to honor our founders and to preserve our constitutional system of government. We have to impeach President Trump, but mm-hmm. she has not given any specific constitutional violation mm-hmm. he's done. They've made up all these accusations against him. They found Democratic donors and Obama appointees in the deep state to bring charges against the president. When they weren't able to prove those charges, they use the saying that sometimes hearsay is better than evidence. And even that, when it comes down to it, even if everything they've said about President Trump in this impeachment case is true, and he did really try to blackmail the president of Ukraine for political advantage, and far of like specific laws broken, that's a civil violation of campaign finance law, which is not even one of the laws enshrined in the Constitution. That's one of the laws Congress has passed since then. So, yeah, the Trump administration's violations of the Constitution have nothing to do with this. At the end of the day, it's the fact that the Trump administration is trying to rein in government bureaucracies mm-hmm. that aren't in the Constitution. That's the main sin for which they're trying to impeach him.
I just can't help but think back to the statements that Gerald Fleury has made about how much Donald Trump's election is exposing what corruption existed, what we're calling the deep state, this entity within the government that wants to run it by their own dictates. That there's so much of this that the way that Nancy Pelosi and so many of her ilk are behaving, this would never have been exposed to the degree that it has had Hillary Clinton been elected, had they been able to just proceed with business as usual. But because you have this man in office who is willing to combat them and to willing to push back against this, then you're getting behavior that is more and more off the rails. And it's showing just how far, like Gerald Fleury has said, how far they're willing to go in order to cling to power, in order to reclaim power. It's all very illuminating just watching all of this unfold in a way that never would have had things not unfolded the way that they did with Donald Trump coming to power. If you want to direct people to more information, where would you send them on this subject?
Probably have two key articles from Mr. Fleury that we can put in the show notes. For just the a more biblical understanding of why this temporary resurgent ended in America and why all of this corruption is being exposed, we can put in Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily.
Yeah.
But then for kind of a look on the other side of the coin about just this lawless, no holds barred, do whatever it takes to take down the government spirit that's taken hold of the Democratic Party. You have another article entitled "The Kavanaugh Hearings Reveal America's Lawless Spirit." And between the two of those, it really delves into why the Democrat Party is trying to tear down the Constitution and the Trump administration, and what the Bible says about the Trump administration's victories in exposing that corruption, at least in the short term.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. We'll put links to both of those articles in the show notes for the program, and you can find that on thetrumpet.com. Meanwhile, as America has been involved in this internal battle, Iran has been developing nuclear-capable ballistic missiles. Well, this week, officials from France, Germany, and Britain stepped forward to criticize Iran for doing so. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brenton Octagal.
We hear a lot about ballistic missiles, and maybe it's something that we don't really focus on too much, or we don't recognize how significant it is. But these are missiles that are capable of carrying a very large weapon a long distance. And according to the Iran nuclear deal that Iran still maintains that it is adhering to in many ways, they're not meant to, or at least the deal urges them not to conduct missile tests that of missiles that are able to carry a nuclear weapon. These are missiles that can generally hold a payload of over 1,000 pounds and that can go for a distance of over a couple hundred miles. And what they have been doing this past year, and this report by the UK, France, and Germany details four separate tests where they have done exactly that, fired different versions of these missiles, some of them going about up to 1,000 miles in range. And in four instances, they are able to carry a nuclear weapon. Of course, Iran will come out and say, we're not testing nuclear capable ballistic missiles because we don't have a nuclear weapons program.
Right.
And so it doesn't matter. so they're saying that they're not doing it, and then the UK, Germany, and France saying that they are, and that they have now got the ability to deliver a nuclear weapon, something that they didn't have back in 2015. They didn't have the ability to do that. And so this is what a lot of people were against the nuclear deal for, was the fact that, yes, you might have put a slowdown on Iran's nuclear program in terms of producing the nuclear weapon for at least 10 years, as that was the deal. But they can use that time to then develop a delivery system, which they didn't have before the start of the nuclear deal. But now they have one of those critical components for a nuclear weapon, that is the ability to deliver it a great distance.
Maybe you could just talk about the specifics that these, I guess it was the officials from these countries were citing as evidence that Iran is breaking the terms that it agreed to in that deal.
Well, again, there's the specific statement that backed up the new UN resolution. I forget the number of it, but it basically said that it calls on Iran to not go forward and develop ballistic missiles capable of delivering a nuclear weapon. There were four separate tests that it discussed, one of them being in April 23rd. This is where a Shahab-3 medium-range ballistic missile was fired. And this missile can go quite far. It can go up to about 500 or 600 kilometers. There was the Borkan 3 that was launched on April 2nd, and this was done by the Houthis. So the Houthis have this technological ability as well. Which incidentally, today it was reported that Iran was caught by the United States trying to smuggle more advanced weaponry to the Houthis as well. Then there was a July 24th. Launch of a Shahab-3 that flew over 1,000 kilometers as well. And then it also details this attempted launch of a satellite into space, which is very similar to the ballistic missile. So there's four separate attempts by Iran, three of them successful, showing that they are honing their abilities to use this ballistic missile technology.
How significant is it that, France and Germany in particular are coming around to essentially the same view that, Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking about this, the Trump administration has been talking about this, and they're essentially agreeing.
Yeah, they are. They are essentially agreeing. I mean, it is. We're producing an article for thetrumpet.com right now on this, and the first title of it said European nations confront Iran over nuclear capable missiles. And I wanted to change that because Europe is, while they are coming around to the American position, it's still just words. I think it is a significant change because they are champions of the nuclear deal and they want Iran to stay in it. And even last week, they decided that they're going to have other nations come on board to help them bail them out of the sanctions. So there is a change. Definitely, but it's still not as strong as what would be necessary to prevent them from doing that. But we know the biblical prophecy talks about Europe hardening its position to the point that they would legitimately confront Iran over this, over something like this. And so these are steps towards that process, or as part of that process.
Tell us about this this New York Times report about Iranian missile smuggling.
Yeah, the New York Times came out with a pretty compelling piece showing that Iran is smuggling its medium, more short-range ballistic missiles. These travel about 600 kilometers into Iraq, and we've talked about how Iran controls a lot of the Shiite militias in Iraq, and these Shiite militias control a lot of the roadways and the border crossings as well. And so they're using this now to move in some serious weaponry that could be fired from Iraq and hit other destinations. These are short-range, precision-guided, many of the missiles, which if you're in Western Iraq, or actually not, if you're in Baghdad, then Jerusalem becomes in range of these weapons. The short range can't reach Israel from Tehran, or it's from Iran's territory. And so now that they've gobbled up Iraq largely, they can use that as a forward operating base towards Israel. And the New York Times basically is confirming this and confirming the reason for a lot of Israeli strikes, covert Israeli strikes on Iraq over the past 6 months, because the Israeli intelligence was aware of this.
Anything that you would want to direct our listeners to for more of the prophetic understanding of why this is significant?
Definitely read, if you haven't, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flory's book, The King of the South. It documents Iran's rise, its prophetic rise, and how it is going to control Iraq and how it is going to move towards in its pursuit towards a nuclear weapon, to having one of those bombs.
Thank you for that, Brent. We will put a link to The King of the South in the show notes. Russian President Vladimir Putin has called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And he's been working to repair that damage. And this week, we saw evidence of just how much success he's having in a development over the nation of Belarus. For this story, we will go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Belarus's ambassador to Russia said that the two countries are really ramping up their efforts to establish a single government. So it's a government that would essentially merge Belarus into Russia. And it would be it would create a supranational entity called the Union State of Russia and Belarus. So the ambassador said that Russian President Vladimir Putin and Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko are personally working on this project. They're working to create a unified tax system, a common market for things like oil and gas. They're working on a single currency, a single military structure, and even a single parliament and government that would have executive authority. And this is all really continuing a plan that's been in the works since the late 1990s to merge the two together. And the implementation of this plan has really lagged over the last couple of decades, but Putin and Lukashenko now appear eager to do whatever it takes to make it a reality. They've now ironed out the details for 20 out of 31 roadmaps, which are, you know, specific action steps that are part of this plan. And tomorrow, December 7th, they'll be meeting again to finalize more steps of this plan. So it looks like after, you know, just about two decades of really floundering, this merger plan could take off.
So I kind of alluded to it in the introduction, but maybe you could just put this in the context of, say, Vladimir Putin's larger strategic plan here.
Sure, yes. As you said, one of Putin's main goals throughout his 20 years, close to it, as the leader of Russia, has been to kind of recreate the Soviet Union. He once called the collapse of that Soviet Union the greatest catastrophe of the 20th century. When you consider things like the Holocaust and, you know, Mao Zedong's great leap forward that happened, it's hard to say that that was a catastrophe by any stretch of the imagination. But for Putin, one of his priorities has been to rebuild it, to kind of return to the days when Belarus and Ukraine and Georgia and 11 other countries were forged under the Russian hammer into that Soviet bloc. And so in 2008, we saw him kind of rehammer a big part of Georgia back into Russia. In 2014, we saw another big hammer strike with Ukraine. You know, he took the Crimea and forged it back into what used to be, kind of returned it back under Russia's control. And so now with Belarus, they've always been very, very closely aligned politically, but it's been in an unofficial way. But now it may be that unofficial is no longer enough, and that he wants to return it to being an official part of Russia's control. And one big reason why Putin may want to do this right now is because his popularity and trust ratings are plummeting. This year, Russia had over 1,400 protests, which is a record-breaking number. 60% of Russians say the country needs a leadership change. His personal trust rating is down to its lowest level in 13 years. And he has, in the past, when his trust has been very low, he's done these kind of expansionist activities outside of Russia. You know, 13 years ago was the record low. Right after that is when he invaded Georgia and took a fifth of that country's territory. And that caused his ratings to soar. Same thing happened in 2013. His trust ratings were very low, his popularity was low. But then it soared into the stratosphere after he took the Crimea. So this could be a big way for him to kind of give Russians a reason to rally around the flag and forget about their personal suffering because of economic downfall that they're all kind of experiencing right now. So that would be a big motivation for him to want to act on this right now. And then the last reason I'll mention for why he would want to make this merger happen now is because Russia's constitution stipulates that a president has to leave office after two consecutive terms. And so Putin is in his second of two terms right now, and he would have to leave office in 2024.
Yeah.
when this one ends. Now, in the past, we have seen him very craftily sidestep yep. the Constitution. We saw this castling move with the Prime Minister. Something like that could happen again. We could also see him amend the Constitution to prevent him having to leave. But both of those options carry some political risks.
Yep.
And if he is able to create a brand new political entity with Belarus and instead become president of that and then imbue that office with more power than the president of Russia has, then he would have no need to sidestep the Constitution, no need to alter it, and he could stay power of stay in control of a bloc that's even more powerful than Russia.
What's in it for Belarus?
Probably not much, but they have very little power against Russia. Yeah. So, I mean, they do get energy deals. Their economy is closely entwined with Russia's, but it's mostly just they're essentially a vassal state, and they have to do what they're told to a degree. Lukashenko is not crazy about being called a vassal state, and he often tries to stand up for himself
yeah.
and for Belarus, but essentially there's not much they could do.
Just looking at news that's coming out about how much Putin's power is kind of under threat, and the idea that he's entering this period. I mean, 2024 is quite a ways off, and yet, as what typically happens when someone is in the last term of office, there's this kind of sense of lame duck status that limits their effectiveness within their office. To see how that may influence Putin and the decisions that he makes. You know, there are obviously people out there that are saying he's entering the sunset years of his power, and then other people like Lukashenko basically say, no, this guy can't be underestimated. He's going to find a way to stay in power. Exactly how this plays out will be very interesting, considering what Gerald Fleury has said about him and this prophesied prince of Russia and him. I mean, Gerald Fleury has never been absolutely unequivocal about the idea that that it's Vladimir Putin, but there's very strong indications that it is. Maybe you could just comment about that a little bit to wind the segment down.
Yeah, sure. You know, the Bible talks about an end-time Asian bloc that will play a big role in the events that lead up to the return of Jesus Christ. It's said to have an army of 200 million men, many orders of magnitude larger than any military force that's ever existed. And there is a chapter in Ezekiel that says it'll be led by a prince of Rosh, or Russia. And Mr. Fleury, as you said, has really identified Vladimir Putin's office as fulfilling that role. And he said in our September 2014 issue, he wrote, "I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead the 200 million man army. I see nobody else on the horizon who could do that. This much is absolutely certain. The restoring of Russia's power by Vladimir Putin, the Prince of Russia, was prophesied."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, possibly someone else could be in that office, but it seems like Mr. Fleury feels almost sure that it would be Putin himself. So when we see, Putin's Russia working to bring these former Soviet countries like Belarus back under the Soviet hammer, really, or the Russian hammer, I think it does serve as more evidence that he is fulfilling that office, the prophesied prince of Russia.
Well, Jeremiah has written an article that will be going up on thetrumpet.com, Soviet Reunion, Russia and Belarus Push Toward Common State. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com, and also we'll put a link to our booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, written by Gerald Fleury, discussing this subject from a prophetic standpoint. Thanks for that very much, Jeremiah. Our newest Trumpet edition, the January 2020 edition, has a cover story by Gerald Fleury about the leadership void in Germany. The problems facing the ruling coalition continue to mount as a major party in the government of Chancellor Angela Merkel prepares to hold its party conference this weekend. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this really is a fascinating subject to watch just kind of right after we sent that issue of the Trumpet off to press. So last weekend, the Social Democratic Party had elections for a new set of leaders. So this is Germany's main left-wing party. You know, maybe you could say they're equivalent to the Democrats. And they are Angela Merkel's coalition partners. For quite a few years now, they've governed in partnership. with Miss Merkel. So they were picking their leaders, plural, over the weekend. The kind of the new trendy thing to do among left-wing parties in Germany is to have two leaders, one man and one woman. The Green Party started doing that. The SPD, SPD is copying them in that. And it was quite an upset. It surprised a whole lot of people what happened in that leadership vote. The favorites lost, and instead it was a pair of unknowns, basically, that ended up winning that election, Saskia Esken and Norbert Walter-Borjans. They won 53% to 45.33% against their competitors there at the end. So these two individuals are from the very much the left wing of the SPD. And as part of that, they're some of the most outspoken critics of this coalition deal. Their rivals, meanwhile, were very much in favor and spoke a lot in support of the coalition. So when faced with this kind of very stark choice between pro-coalition or anti-coalition, Social Democratic members chose anti-coalition. Mm-hmm. And the election of these two has really thrown a whole lot of things up in the air. The Local wrote, the shock result heralded a week of uncertainty for the coalition, with next Friday, that's today, a key date. And we'll talk about some of what's going on in just a second. Bloomberg, they talked about how this could be a very big change. They talked about how, well, they wrote, the current government of the European Union's largest economy has been inexcusably mediocre and is badly in need of change. It talked about how it's been paralyzed. And then they concluded, the coming weeks and months will make history in post-war Germany, which is not used to such turmoil. So they see this leadership election as potentially presaging a big break within the coalition and a lot of political turmoil. Now, at that meeting today, the Social Democratic leaders, they didn't push hard for a break with Miss Merkel. Instead, what they got the party to vote on was a resolution where they would go back to Chancellor Merkel and they would say, we will continue to support your coalition, but we want more. You know, we had a coalition deal. That's not good enough. We want several more left-wing policies. And we still have to see how that plays out. You know, both the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats, they're both hemorrhaging voters. They're both hemorrhaging voters on their wings. You know, this is why the Social mm-hmm. Democrats voted in a more far left party, because further left parties are eating their lunch. Meanwhile, you've got exactly the same thing with the Christian Democrats. They're not going to have much room for compromise.
Yeah.
Because they've got if they move too far to the left, then they're going to lose votes. So, you know, exactly how this plays out, we don't know, but there's still every chance now that the coalition could fall in the coming months.
So what sort of options does this give the Christian Democrats? I guess you almost wonder if they would be forced to, if they did have to dissolve this coalition, could they create something with those on the right of them?
Well, I think what people seem to be saying is the most likely option is that they would keep going with a minority government. They've got their budget passed. That's kind of one of the big hard things to get passed. They don't need to do another budget for quite a while. People do seem to think, well, they could keep going as a minority and just kind of try and get new people to pass laws on a case by case basis.
Right.
Now, that's not though popular in Germany, the idea of a minority government. Angela Merkel previously ruled it out, because a minority government was kind of one of the key stepping stones to the rise of the Nazis, where you had a minority government that struggled to get anything done. And people are kind of wary of repeating that history. But so much of the history around the rise of the Nazis has already repeated itself with the hemorrhaging of support of these mainstream parties. They may not have any choice but to repeat that particular bit of history. So I think people are saying if the coalition falls apart, you would probably get a minority government that would continue for a short amount of time, you know, maybe several months. It seems unlikely to be able to keep going all the way until the next elections, which would be scheduled, I think, for the autumn of 2021. So that would be very much an interim solution. And if the coalition fell apart, we would probably be looking at fresh elections at some point in 2020.
So the way that Gerald Flory wrote about this in his article, the cover story of the January 2020 edition focuses on the possibility that these kinds of problems within the governing coalition in Germany would pave the way for a strong man to emerge. And obviously, we've been looking at Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg for a long time. There's nothing necessarily specifically happening right now that points to him as an individual, but what are your thoughts about, say, the way that these conditions are preparing the way for something like that to happen?
Yeah, this is actually something that Mr. Flory talked about as well in the January 2019 Trumpet edition. And in that article, he just made the point, there's a whole load of Bible prophecies about a strong leader coming to power in Germany. You've got ones in Daniel chapter 8 that talk about this strong leader. There's one in Daniel chapter 11 that even talks about how this strong leader will come into power. And he talks about this a bit as well in the latest Trumpet print edition. And it talks about he'll come into power by flatteries. And, you know, you look at what the Hebrew word here means, and it's talking about intrigues, behind the scenes maneuverings, coalition negotiations, not through just a normal, straightforward election. And you know, in that 2019 article, Mr. Flory wrote, current conditions in Europe, including the refugee crisis and the turmoil in German politics, provide probably one of the greatest opportunities ever for a new leader to come into power by flatteries. And I think that's what we see with the events of the last week, and that's what we're going to see just going forwards now in Germany. You've got weak parties. It's very hard for you to get a strong leader by traditional means right now. That's leading to a whole lot of uncertainty. It's all dependent on coalition negotiations and backroom deals, and a government could fall and you could have other kind of negotiations coming in. And there's no solution for this on the horizon. Nobody in Germany right now at the top of German politics has any idea how to fix this, how to return to the era of stable governments that Germany what used to be famous for. So you've got this situation now where it's perfect for someone to come in by flatteries, and there's no sign of that ending in the near future. So I think we've really got the path is there, the conditions are there for this strongman to come onto the scene, you know, whenever it's time. And you can really see how those prophecies, I think, are right on the brink of being fulfilled.
Well, thank you for that. We'll put a link to the both January 2020 article cover story by Gerald Flory and the January 2019 article, as well as his booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. And we thank you very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, stories about more cooperation between Russia and China while the fractures in the NATO alliance grow wider. Those stories and more right after this break.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The next few stories show how rapidly a new world order is emerging. America's dominance, cemented by alliances in Europe and Asia, is crumbling, and powerful new alliances within Asia and other places are developing that challenge America. One of the most remarkable is that between Russia and China, who keep finding additional ways to strengthen their partnership in a way that promises to change the world. For the latest of these means, we will go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this was really a huge week for Russia-China relations because of a new pipeline that opened up between the two of them. And the story really starts all the way back in March of 2014. That was the year that Russia annexed part of Ukraine, which we spoke about in the first half. And most of the Western world at that time was shocked by that and really condemned Russia for it. They put sanctions on Russia to try to isolate them. But China came out in support of Russia's annexation of Crimea. And while the rest of the world was kind of turning a cold shoulder to Russia, China seemed to take the occasion to really even ramp up its business dealings with the Russians and its general partnership. So that was in March that annexation happened. And then 2 months later, May of 2014, Russia's state-owned gas company, Gazprom, and China's state-owned National Petroleum Corps signed a contract to build a pipeline stretching from Siberia all the way down to a location near China's border, and then with an extension into China. This contract stipulated that Russia would sell natural gas to China through this pipeline for 30 years. So they've been working on this ever since then. And then on Monday of this week, after 5 years of construction, the pipeline called the Power of Siberia opened. So it stretches about 2,000 miles, if you include that extension, and it is now sending deliveries of Russian natural gas into China. Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping had a joint video call that they both attended to kind of be there to watch the launching ceremony together in a way. And they called this just really a landmark development and a milestone in their bilateral ties. This will pump 1.3 trillion cubic feet per year of Russian natural gas into China once it hits full capacity. And anyway, so this project that just had its big culmination this week really is a deeply significant geopolitical development.
Where would you send people for more information?
We have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, and it really talks about the scriptural backing that prophesied the modern partnership that we're now seeing between Russia and China. Goes through numerous prophecies and scriptural passages that just show that this was written about thousands of years ago, and now we see it becoming a reality with projects such as this pipeline.
Well, thank you, Jeremiah. As Russia and China come together, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the alliance between America and Europe principally, is on very rocky ground. To look at the latest evidence of this from this past week, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, NATO had their birthday party this week, the 70th anniversary of the foundation of NATO. And it was quite the contrast to the 60th anniversary. The EU Observer wrote, "What a difference a decade makes. NATO's 60th birthday celebration in 2009 was a show of confidence sprinkled with the stardust of Barack Obama's first official visit to Europe." And then they wrote, "By contrast, the 70th anniversary finds the alliance looking doddery and unsure." And that's exactly right. You've got Turkey going off doing their own thing in the Middle East and kind of even against the wishes of other NATO allies. You've got French President Emmanuel Macron calling the alliance brain dead. You've had debate after debate within Europe saying, well, what do we need to do now that we're not sure NATO will protect us? We need some kind of European army. I've seen so many articles along those lines over the past fortnight or so. You had that almost, high school type situation where the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and a few others were kind of caught making fun of Mr. Trump behind his back on video, and this ended up dominating the conference, and Mr. Trump ended up kind of skipping some of the closing events. And you know, I think it's telling that that is pretty much the biggest story from the conference. At the 60th anniversary party, you know, there were all kinds of big announcements. There were declarations about new approaches to different things, and France was reintegrating its command structure back into NATO. This time, you know, the biggest news story is some almost schoolgirl type incident where world leaders offend each other. It's a pretty vivid demonstration that NATO is falling apart and that it's not the force that it once was. And this is a very important trend that we've been watching. Probably one of the best places I could send you to learn more about this is an article that Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory wrote in August 2008 called Germany and Russia's Secret War Against America. And that article really shows how Europe, and most particularly Germany, have already broken with America in foreign policy in a whole load of really important ways. They're working against America, so no longer this NATO no wonder this NATO alliance doesn't really work. And in that article, Mr. Flory takes you through several prophecies and shows how this is forecast to happen. The Bible talks about this very specifically. It's a very important event in what's prophesied to happen in the end times, this break and this turning away where America trusts Europe, looks to Europe for help, and Europe betrays America, and Germany betrays America.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. That was outstanding. America's relationship with Latin American countries is also hitting rockier ground. For evidence of this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, trade war is intensifying as President Trump announced Monday that he would be increasing U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum coming from Argentina and Brazil. Now, the president last year had announced similar tariffs on China and the European Union in an attempt to protect American manufacturers. But Brazil and Argentina were initially supposed to come under those, but were able to negotiate a deal last minute to be able to keep tariff-free trade flowing between the two countries. But then on Monday, President announced in a Twitter post that Brazil and Argentina have been presiding over a massive devaluation of their currencies, which is not good for our farmers. Thus, immediately I will restore the tariffs on all steel and aluminum that is shipped to the U.S. from these countries. So this is a measure that's it's targeting steel and aluminum, but according to the announcement, supposed to be an attempt to pressure these countries into more fair trade practices on agriculture. Brazil is a rising agricultural power, even challenging the United States in some ways for the title of world's breadbasket as they ship more and more grain and soybeans to China and other countries. And so these tariffs may help American manufacturers and maybe even American farmers in the short term. But it is also going to push Brazil and Argentina to trade more with the other two power blocks that President Trump put tariffs on last year, China and the European Union, which is exactly what we expect from Bible prophecy in Isaiah 23. It talks about this end-time trade block against America and the nations of Israel, dominated largely by Kittim, Tarshish, and Tyre, which are ancient names for China, Japan, and the European Union, Tyre being the chief trading port for the ancient Assyrian Empire. Latin America is not specifically mentioned, but it does have strong ties to that old Holy Roman Empire and its modern form in the European Union. And as Mr. Gerald Floyd brought out in a recent article that we can put in the show notes titled America is Being Besieged Economically, just logistically, you can't besiege the continent of North America unless Latin America is part of that siege.
Where would you send people for more information?
Well, in addition to that, the article, America is Being Besieged Economically, we also have our Isaiah's End Time Vision booklet by Mr. Fleury. There's a chapter in there called Building Towards a World Catastrophe, which specifically goes through Isaiah 23 and its prophetic ramifications in the end time.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. One last story. There is an unmistakable rise in anti-Semitism in Europe, and it's showing itself in a number of ways. This week, actions taken by national parliaments in European countries showed the struggle taking place over this explosive issue. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yes, there was a really positive announcement by the French National Parliament, the French National Assembly. For Israelis and Jews everywhere, they decided to adopt the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism. This definition of anti-Semitism is something that's debated often across the world, and that is that anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism, which means if you're against the Israeli state, you are now, well, the French Parliament, and this passed 154-72, they believe that that is a form of anti-Semitism. It could be that you could have gotten away with, and in many places you can, saying that I'm not anti-Semitic, I love the Jews, but I just hate that the fact of, or Israel's policies, and I hate that Israel, that the Jews have their state in Israel, something that shouldn't have happened. It's a travesty of international justice against the Palestinians. But now the French are coming out and saying, well, no, we can't
say that anymore. That is anti-Semitism, to deny the Israeli state's right to exist. The resolution stated this in part. It said, quote, "For some years now, France, the whole of Europe, but also almost all Western democracies are facing a rise in anti-Semitism. Anti-Zionist acts can at times hide anti-Semitic realities. Hate toward Israel due to its perception as a Jewish collective is akin to hatred towards the entire Jewish community." And so this is something that Israel is very happy with, and editorials across the board were very praiseworthy of the French for this decision, because the France is facing their own scourge of anti-Semitism right now within their country. About half the hate crimes in France are now perpetrated against Jews, which only make up about 1% of the population. And so they see anti-Semitism, and now they are, at least in speech, coming across to support Israel in this way. And that was the European Court of Justice, and that ruling that they made wasn't binding on the individual nations. They would have had to come up with what they wanted to do, and the Dutch already rejected that ruling, the Dutch government, the French government as well. And so I think what's interesting about this is you do have a fight within European circles, governmental circles, and especially between the European Union and some of the member states as to how they feel towards Israel. And this is something that's going to go on. I think it's just very interesting that regardless of whether it looks like it's a pro message or an anti message against the Jews, an anti-Semitic message or a pro Jewish message, anti-Semitism is obviously the hot topic because nobody can deny that it exists and it is in discussion all through Europe right now.
So tell us about this second measure.
This is a bill that has passed through one of the houses inside the Irish Parliament. And you brought up the measure of the Court of Justice that Israel would have to label goods that come out of the settlements inside the West Bank or the Golan Heights or even East Jerusalem with such a label. Now, this bill that might become a law that looks like it's going to pass, unless it's just trumped by the leader of Ireland. It is even worse than that. This is a bill that would actually penalize and criminalize any merchant inside Ireland that decides to sell any product that had its origin inside a settlement. And so it's not even putting a label on it. You can't even do that. You can face up to 5 years in prison, up to €250,000 fine for even trying to sell one of these goods that come out of the West Bank or East Jerusalem or the Golan Heights.
The rise in anti-Semitism is a subject that we have talked quite a lot about. And maybe you could just summarize why this is so important from a prophetic standpoint and where you would point people to for more information about this.
Sure. So that was from Ireland, and this Ireland looks like they're on this extreme. You have another couple of nations in Europe as well that are similar to that, but it is alarming, certainly, of what's been taking place. And we have prophesied this rise in anti-Semitism to return to Europe. It looks like Europe is going to have this kind of two faces in terms of anti-Semitism for a long time, because Israel itself is prophesied to trust European nations with some of their defense in the future. But at the same time, we know that these historic hostilities to the Jewish people that have shown up in Europe for hundreds and hundreds of years have not gone away. If people want to read more about that and its importance to watch this rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, you can read "Pay Attention to Rising Anti-Semitism in Europe and Britain" by Mr. Brad McDonald.
Thank you very much for that, Brent. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah and Steve Herkus for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Pythagoras: "Rest satisfied with doing well, and leave others to talk of you as they please." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.